listen. We've got an extensive HIV and AIDS program that has run for 3 years and will go for another year. In these programs and roles, we have a number of focus areas. Obviously, internally, to build the sexist capacity and academic capabilities. Two is about the core business of the sector, research, innovation, and technological capabilities, as well as collaborations internationally and continentally. We have a specific focus to enhance the sector's contribution to national imperatives, specific skills, collaboration, and then finally, organizing for effective and efficient delivery. Now, HIPAA is the body serving the sector. It's owned by the sector, and the sector is made up of 22 universities after the mergers of 2004-2005. We have 11 traditional universities, if you wish, 6 universities with technology, and 6 comprehensive universities, the latter being the result of a merger between a former traditional university and a former technicon. Examples include the University of Johannesburg and UNISA. There are also in the country 2 national institutes in Mpumalanga and the Northern Cape, still falling under the auspices of the Department of Education. With regard to enrollments, we have had a strong increase from 1999 to 2007. In actual fact, the preliminary figures for 2008 indicate that there are over 800,000 students in public higher education institutions. As part of the secondary sector, we also have 50 public further education training colleges, and in 2008, approximately 400,000 students in those. Approximately 330,000 students are enrolled as private higher education providers, and they are all accredited by the department and by the Council for Higher Education. And of the 800,000 students, there's less than 10%, 60,000 international students, mostly from the rest of Africa, enrolled in our institutions. The achievement of the sector in terms of growth has been that for the last 7-8 years, we've grown by about 5% per annum, undergraduate enrollments, PhDs 6.6%, African students, specifically 6%, women students 5.5%. African students now make up 63% of the public higher education numbers, up from 58%, and in 2008 it was slightly more. Women, perhaps I should just say, we use the 2007 figures, Chair, because they're the official figures that we have, but informally it's clear that there's been a huge growth in 2008 because of the additional 20,000 matriculants who gained university access. We had a big peak in 2008, so these numbers are on the conservative side. Women students now make up 56% of the numbers, up from 52%. Enrollments in SET have grown by 4.3%, slightly lower than the average, and the number of graduates has been increasing by almost 6%, and public research, publication research outputs 4.7%. So there's been a good and steady growth in the sector, and with 2008 not yet shown in the official figures, some of these figures will probably be on the conservative side. What are the challenges facing the system?
Acting Chair, may I ask a question? Vice Chancellor, the PhD figures that I've been looking at, these are PhD bursaries awarded over the last 4 years, from 2005 to 2008, indicate a stagnation, not a growth. So your 6% per annum growth for PhDs is an interesting figure, because my records show that there hasn't been an increase. There are some issues around foreign students and South African students as well graduating.
Yeah. Chair, let me say that obviously this figure represents 8 years, 2000 to 2010 inclusive. It is true, however, that across all universities there's been a stagnation in both PhDs and master's students. All of the universities, or most of the universities with an interest in this, are are investigating what is the reason for this. We think there are probably three reasons. The one is that we've had economic growth in the last 3-4 years, and many students go and have job offers that is much more lucrative than studying further. So that might be one possibility. Second possibility is that the career prospects of an academic, and your majority of students doing PhDs are doing that for academic and career opportunities, are not that lucrative, and it seems to be less than the private sector. So that's a second reason. And thirdly, it may be that we haven't kept up as universities with the types of bursaries to be awarded to masters and PhD students. So because the bursary can't help you, if you think a senior honor student, or let's take a master's student, it's very difficult these days to work and do a PhD at the same time. So most students would like to do that full time. To be able to do that, you can't only look at the student's cost, you must also look, Chair, at the family, because often those students are married. And I think universities are realizing that we should do a little bit more to give higher bursaries. But so yes, it is true that in the stagnation of the last 2-3 years, we are looking into that and have different strategies for that.
A follow-up observation, that in terms of the human resource development strategy for the country, we're supposed to graduate 1,700 PhDs by 2018. That date has now been revised, been pushed forward back to 2022, I think. This is in the science area. And so we need to seriously revise our projections, because if we're going to meet the HRD goals, then we need to do something quite drastic, in fact. And you're hinting at one, that is that the support for PhD students would have to increase, but also the support for postdoctoral qualifications would have to increase as well. So it's a serious issue.
Yeah, perhaps I could just say that the sector is also aware that in the past, the Department of Education and the Department of Science and Technology had not perhaps coordinated their efforts enough. The DST had a very laudable initiative launched about 2 years ago to get us to 10,000 PhDs. But it wasn't done with the full cooperation and agreement of the Department of Education. And we hope that with a new minister there, both at DST, who was the Minister of Education, and the new minister, there will be better coordination, because 10,000 clearly is a very, very ambitious figure. But if we join forces of those two departments, also in terms of financial resources, and you say, let's go for 4,000 by 2020, then it's possible. Thank you, Chair. Chair, the challenges, briefly, the proportion of students enrolled in science, engineering, technology has remained fairly constant at about 28-29%. And this was mainly due to an increase of enrollments in business and management. And we need to work on that. Further work also needs to be done to increase the participation rate. I presume everyone knows that the participation rate is the percentage of 18 to 25-year-olds participating in higher education. It's increased from 1% from 50% to 60%. But the goal of the National Plan for Higher Education in 2001 is that we should reach 20% by about 2015. That's not clear. Again, here, may I say that I think that we as a sector feel that in many countries of the world, the best practice is now to not only look at higher education, but also look at the post-secondary sector. So in many countries, they include in the participation rate, the rate of participation in the FET colleges or likewise organizations. Third challenge, high dropout rates and low graduation rates. There's been studies done about this. Finances is a big reason. That's why NHS is important. But also literacy. I think it would be a miss from us to say that although it's not yet clear, but early indications are that the batch of students that we received this year in our universities are less prepared, worse prepared than those indications from universities with their half-year marks indicate that, especially in maths and sciences, we have a problem. Now, we'll do our job. We don't want to be seen to always be blamed with the school system, but it may be that we'll have a bit of a drop in graduation rates and also a higher dropout rate for these students. And then finally, although participation access is not a problem anymore, we believe the problem is that success is still skewed in favor of white and Indian students. Fewer of African and colored students finish their studies. We must remember that many of these students, by far the majority, are so-called first-generation students. And it's not easy to go to university for the first time when no one in your family has ever done so. There are also issues of culture and language, etc., etc. But those are the four main challenges here. Funding trends, always important at the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee. We are very grateful in the last number of years the previous minister has increased funding for higher education in terms of a number of categories, special earmark allocations, especially for the mergers and incorporations, infrastructural grant that will kick in 2010 of 2.3 billion, 3.2 billion, in which universities have to match that with about 40%, depending on the size of your university. And then also a small increase in block grants. Now, block grants are the sort of core money that we get to run the university. You'll understand that earmarked allocations are for specific things like mergers. Infrastructure grants are specifically for areas like engineering or life sciences. The problem is that our problem lies in running the institutions. And so the block grants, although there's been a small increase, it's actually decreased in real terms since 2000. And therefore, we were forced to increase our income from other sources, such as tuition fees. And that obviously created a problem. Contract research, endowments, commercialization, etc., etc. On average, 40%, just about 40% of all income from universities are from government. But there are universities that earns as much as 55%, close to 60%, because of the lack of third-stream income. This is down from 49% in 2000. So universities had to become less dependent on government because of the real decrease in block grants. Student fees went up to 29%. Again, it would be up from about 25% to 23%. And then private income, donations, commercialization, contract research has gone up to 31%, up from 37% in 2000. So it shows that there's a trend. This trend has not been arrested. It's not been stopped by the infrastructural grants, although that does help us to alleviate some of the pressures on the universities. Perhaps I should also say that from our side, most universities, although we've increased our student intake with 6% over the years, we have not increased the appointment of staff, especially academic staff. So academic staff are laboring under a huge burden because they've got sometimes double the students they had 5-7 years ago. And we have not yet been able to, we have not been able to appoint more staff to look after the needs of those students. And obviously, when you play an almost remedial role with students, learners who come from school who cannot read properly, who cannot write properly, then you need more intensive attention. And you can't work with one lecturer in a class of 200. That just won't help us to go forward. What are the implications? I've said that we increased our share of income from student fees, private income. Increased student fee levels have had the consequence that some academically deserving but poor students have not been able to access higher education. The private income areas like short courses sometimes jeopardize the core functions of teaching, learning, research, and community service. And we believe that we must find an appropriate balance between the so-called first, second, and third streams. And in this regard, in this part, can become instrumental in attaining this balance. I'll share very briefly on NSFUS. In 2008, almost 200,000 awards were granted to eligible students. This included 38,000 to FET students. The number of students at FET colleges was 35,000. 55,000 students of the Funchala Shaka, that is specifically earmarked for education, to try to draw more students into the education profession. So 5,000 of the 182 were for education students. And in 2008, 3,600 benefited through the Department of Social Development for Social Work Training. So those are two specific categories of NSFAS funding. Yeah, I think by and large, we believe that NSFAS has been hugely successful. I think previous Minister Manuel, as Minister of Finance, has been on record to say that this is a best practice internationally of how you use funding to give access to higher education and make it work in that about 40% of the funding comes back through repayment of the loans. So you won't find a vice chancellor that's not very positive about NSFAS. Our major strengths, I'll come back to the weaknesses just now. So NSFAS has advanced equity in access. A larger pool of poor students are able to access higher education. NSFAS has also become a disbursal of financial aid of private funds. So universities would often say, here are our funds, please administer it for us. And then especially the loan recovery that I work on. Obviously, Chair, as you will know, the fact that NSFAS works with SARS, so that the moment a student has a job, the repayment of the loan becomes automatic through deductions, makes it much, much easier and makes the risk much, much lower. And therefore, NSFAS has tried and tested administrative and accountability procedures. Areas for improvement, as I said, although we're very positive, we think we can improve. Normally, NSFAS money will be paid out by March, April in the year. And we have a standard administrative procedures that you have to look at. But the problem is that often universities, that is the worst time for cash flow for universities because the first subsidy grants from government comes in April. So for those 4 months, in a sense, we have to work on our own cash reserves. And we would suggest that we look at giving some of those allocations earlier to universities. If a university has a track record of, say, disbursing $50 million a year, we don't think it's a risk to give them $30 million in January under certain conditions. It'll help us to give access to students earlier. When you wait until March, April to see how much funding you have, and you can then only decide, then some fall through the cracks. The finalization of loan agreements between students and NSFAS is too cumbersome and time-consuming. We think that we now should move away from the race-based formula to the existing institutional allocation formula. It should be who are poor students and not who are black and white, because there are white students who are poor, and there are more and more middle-class black students who are not necessarily poor. Thirdly, the criteria for determining eligibility of students for NSFAS support. At the moment, the cut-off for parents' salary is 120,000 Rand. Now you can imagine, Chair, if my parents earned 120,000 Rand and they had to put me to university to take of that 120,000, 30,000 per year, it's just not possible. So we think that threshold is too low, it should become higher. And so the whole way to compile a so-called needs test, we think, needs revisiting. The relationship on the second next page, relation to the bursary and loan component of the application is an ongoing factor. We think that there would be a good case to face in a high incentive bursary component here to also encourage students to do better academically. At the moment, if you do well at a certain level, you can convert 40 or 50% of the loan into bursary. We think this could even be higher because it will be a huge incentive. But obviously, for cash flow reasons, it will have to be phased in. NSFAS support to priority pupils study is important. There's a whole question about NSFAS support to not-for-profit higher education providers, others. We obviously bind the subject directly to faith institutions, but we understand that if there are students who are poor and need money in those areas, then we should look at that. We believe that non-loan paying students should be blacklisted, and we believe that NSFAS's procedure to do this is fair, and that we need to also, amongst our graduates, engender a culture of meeting your commitments, and therefore after many warnings, if one is blacklisted, then that should stay, it should be taken away. And then finally, we believe, without going into much detail, the administrative and allocation practices. We need some help at universities. I think some universities will have to appoint more admin staff to administer the bursaries of NSFAS. But you will remember, Chair, that there's been about a month or so ago, perhaps 2 months ago, a huge outcry where it became known that about 30 million rand of NSFAS money had not been disbursed this year. And the question was asked, is this an administrative managerial problem by universities? And I think we could say by far and large it was not. It was that part of that money students didn't qualify for because of the threshold value, because of the 120,000 rand. We could not disperse it because students didn't meet the criteria. Chair, I'm coming to a conclusion. What are the challenges for the post-secondary system? And in line with the philosophy of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, we think it's important that we talk about the post-secondary system because it's a holistic concept. There are about 2.8 million potential students that are neither studying, employed, or they're not disabled either, so they are out there. Of this, we believe 700,000 students with grade 12 are not studying, employed, or disabled. And approximately 1 million of this 2.8 million have between grade 10 and 12 and they go into the FET sector. So, in summary, there are 700,000 students that could access higher education out there. And there are a million students who could access FET colleges. But our problem is that in South Africa, we have a converse or a reverse image of higher education and FET. Normally, in the rest of the world, you have 5 FET students for every higher education student. If we took our system with 800,000 higher education students, we should actually have 4 million FET students, and we only have 400,000. The minister wants to make that a million in a short time. We agree with that, but we think we can even grow that further. So the biggest challenge now is for us to grow a holistic and integrated post-secondary education system, to make sure that those students who can study have the opportunity either at university or ACT. We also believe, Chair, that part of our problem of a high dropout rate is that there are some students now, because the ACT option is not an attractive one, they are ending up in higher education where they should actually, if they have had good counseling, career counseling, they would have ended, they should have ended up in an ACT college with a more practical approach. Coming back finally to NSFAS, as a result, we believe NSFAS is a transformation tool to promote this equitable differentiation in terms of vocational and academic skills, especially looking at the FET sector, and we believe NSFAS should expand its support to those, and NSFAS should also play a role in distribution of opportunities in an unequal society. Conclusion, we believe a well-functioning and strengthened NSFAS is in the best interest of our society. Although NSFAS loan scheme has broadened poor students' access to higher education, we fully support the review of the Minister for NSFAS because we believe this can really transform the sector even further. Chair, just a last note, ESO is now in its fifth year. It's grown in the last few years. It has a strong capacity. The Vice Chancellors in ESO are acting as a unit. And we pledge our support to the government and to Parliament, obviously, to make sure that we have a higher education sector and where we can play a role, a post-secondary sector that can meet the needs of our country. Thank you very much. I don't know, Chair, whether some of my colleagues would like to add, if you indulge us, I'd ask them.
We wouldn't like to add anything at the moment, but we'll participate in the discussion. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, higher education has made a presentation. It's your time to engage on that. Dr. James, and then the honorable member there, then honorable Muswana. Just like that, thanks.
If I can just make a series of remarks. The first is that there clearly are students at universities who ought not to be at universities, as you were suggesting. And what happens is that university resources are then used to deal with underprepared students, and those resources often are diverted from where the emphasis should be. So if we had a system where the students at universities are qualified to be there in terms of skill and expertise, then we'd have a much better university system as a result. That's one observation. The second one, which then follows, is that the FET college system must expand and must expand rapidly to absorb those students and other students that are eligible. And my question is whether the FET sector has the capacity to absorb so many students. And what would be the resource requirements for that to happen in terms of paying for staff and so on and so forth. And my third comment is simply to ask, is the threshold of 120,000 Rand does not take into account what in fact is current day material realities. And the current day material, you hinted at that. So there are white families who are in the same situation as black families in terms of being lower middle class or upper working class in terms of income levels. And that there are some black families who certainly can privately afford to send students to university. And therefore, what we're looking at presently is not a racial measure to determine this thing, but a class one. And what is stopping NSFAS from actually adjusting its threshold level and its requirements? I presently know that there's a commission of inquiry. Do we need a commission of inquiry? I mean, it seems like quite simple. That the threshold's too low, raise it. And that if we need a class measure for making the determinations, then why don't we use that? Is it embodied in the legislation?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nolita. I said, is it Professor? Thank you. I when you took us through your presentation, it's just a comment that your focus areas in terms of your roles. I like the hand and the voice and the head. And then I also looked at your program. I wish we had more time to actually understand what you were doing in terms of your role, because I don't see that your programs are actually underpinning and supporting your role. I just see that the programs are doing something else and yet your role is something else. And I'm sure further engagement would enable that we understood what you're doing in terms of your head, in terms of your voice, in terms of your hands, because then you influence the outcomes that you want to see. So obviously the programs to me speak to the role that you are playing. So I didn't see that connection, and I'm sure it is there. The second one is the curiosity to see how, and I raised this last time we were with the committee, that I would like to have a perspective on how the measures have performed. What how are they doing? We are concerned, obviously, about the measures, and because there are some kind of, there is a disconnect somewhere where you look at it. But obviously, probably you would provide a better insight in terms of how they are working and what you see as they are going forward. The third one, and I'm sorry to be long, I don't normally interact with vice chancellors anymore, so it's the issue of, you are talking about students that get into the system and students that don't get out of the system. And that is a concern. And we have been talking, I've been raising the issue of a tracker system in higher education. It's okay to give punctuations in terms of who is not coming out. And it's okay to give the reason of finance about that, but what are we doing about that? Why are we losing students in production? If universities are centers of production and we're not producing that which we intended to produce, what are we doing about the waste that is in between, which is actually higher than the input cost? Because we're losing a lot of that future. And for us as well, if you are saying that education participates that highly in economy and we are losing this much of in the process of packaging and distribution, so what happens then? So we're just not happy. The last one for me, there are numerous, believe me, is the blacklisting of the loan non-paying students. And I'm sure there's a reason for that, but the implications of that for what we intend to have, how do we have alternative rehabilitative interventions in order for students not to be, you know, because blacklisting has got, obviously you know that, a lot of implications.
Honorable Musana.
Thank you, Chairperson of the session. I have three very short questions. The first one is from challenges facing higher education system. And I think the former speaker spoke to it, but I think I need to add. The graduation rate, the way they are skewed, we get it here that they are skewed in favor of, it's saying white and Indian students, white more Africans than colored. Although they gain access, they don't graduate, that's what it's saying. But when we go to the areas of improvement, I don't see how that is going to be improved. Because isn't it you come with a challenge, and later we see the improvement. I would like to see the improvement there, or we debate here about what we think should be done to improve that. Because you are maybe a little bit silent on what really causes these ones not to graduate. And then I also want to speak on the tried and tested administrative and accountability measures. That's like the areas of improvement again, where finalization of loan agreement is too long. Yet the administrative say is tried and tested, it's like it's good if I understand it correctly. So I think perhaps we need to look at it and agree that the administrative needs serious attention and not necessarily give it credit. And also, the last question is, maybe the last one, blacklisting, you spoke of it. But can't we agree that this needs to be eradicated? Because I see that you talk of areas of improvement. And the report that we've got, that says that this blacklisted student is not what they are doing. Some of them, after completing, they are not employed. And some parents have not completed, yet they got the loan. And they remain blacklisted. So that we need to talk of who becomes blacklisted and why, and what can be done to ensure that those that found themselves in this situation without their own doing may not be blacklisted. Can't we do that in this country? And I'm checking the time frame to give us the report. It's up to 2007. This is August 2009. I'm checking if it's not possible that by March, because when we deal with schools around the universities, we know that by March, maybe the first 2 weeks, stats will be collected and processing the data. But then, if by this month, we still don't know the exact enrollment for 2008, we need to improve that as well in the future. Otherwise, I want to thank you because this is comprehensive, and for sure you are doing your best. We will support. Thank you.
The chairperson of the committee is Honorable Fransman. I will give over to him to engage also, and then give to Honorable Nelson, and thereafter we will take over the reins as promised. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, I think my apologies were well noted. I've just scanned the presentation, so obviously not have the benefit of the input. But in terms of just very particular questions, dropout rates, so that's your entrance, and there's a great success in the entrance field, but what is the dropout rate? And if it is 50% roughly, what is the reason for that dropout? Because it's no use of having so many people in the system and we are not seeing the actual graduation taking place. So that's one. Secondly, where is the student that has dropped out? Can we actually ask the ESA administration now to go and pull us a list per province of all the students that have dropped out over the last 3 years? What are they doing currently, or where did they drop out from? That is just a very practical. It actually speaks to the colleague that raised the issue of tracking, but it's not only tracking that I would want to know. A third one related to that raw tracking. What happened to the graduates? So we've pumped in money from the NSFAS. Did we see a flight to somewhere being attracted by Australia, the UK, with very wonderful opportunities? So even amongst the 50% that then have gone through the system positively, so what has happened to them, and is there a system to follow that up? Meaning taxpayers' money into them, is the outcome we are servicing in the field of medicine, the whole of Canada, which I think is happening currently, right? Then the issue about a uniform methodology with regard to the different universities. So even amongst the institutions, the methodology on granting the financial assistance. One of the things that we've debated when we went to NSFAS was that it seems to us that in a university, one student studying, say, engineering or finances can most probably get not a full loan or a full bursary, but in another institution with exactly the same principles, that student will get a full one. So the discrepancies when it comes to the various institutions, and if one takes it further than that, not necessarily a question, but I then draw a conclusion, if that statement is proper, I will draw a conclusion between institutions with better capacity, attracting possibly students that can afford, vis-a-vis institutions with lesser capacity, servicing the poorest of the poor, but they're not getting that type of full support. It's that contradiction that I think I am concerned about. The last issue, Chairperson, relates to the actual financial aid offices at these institutions. Is there a document analyzing their capacity in terms of a very structured relation? And are they on par with each other? So just a very direct question. And if that document exists, I think I would really want to see it coming through.
Honorable Nelson.
Thank you. I think the Chairperson has covered more or less what I wanted to raise, and that is the issue of the bursary NSFAF. Because on our visitation to NSFAF, the whole issue of top slicing has come up. And is this not creating a situation or you know, increasing the dropout rate where these bursaries are not full bursaries and it doesn't take them into the next level in their studies? So it's been covered by the Chairperson, but maybe some input around that. And what are the policies? What are the guidelines? And is it left up to each university to you know, just decide on their own how they're going to deal with the NSFAF? Thank you.
Before you respond, Honorable Makubela.
Thanks, Chair. Just a few questions, some of which may be asked from another dimension, even if it relates to the same questions as raised by other honorable members. The first relates to the dropout rate. The question will be, are these students who don't qualify for NSFAF, or what becomes the problem? Do they come in and at a later stage are unable to pay because the major reason was said to be financed? What is it? Don't they qualify after they have entered the institutions? But the other will be, is it possible in terms of your capacity in the event the renewal of NSFAF allocation or distribution of these bursaries to take care of all the needs of students? For instance, their transport from home towards the particular institution once they have actually been enrolled. All those kind of nitty-gritties, can there be capacity, administrative capacity, to can handle that kind of thing? Because currently, the bursaries are not taking care of everything. So it's possible, even if students did qualify, to still drop out later on in the course of their study. There has been this assertion that you're increasing student fees also to make do for some of the things that you're finding it difficult to attend to. And we know that there have been some student protests already in that regard. And we wouldn't want to see a situation where there's instability in these institutions, because also government will have to come in to try and deal with that. To what extent are we able to ensure that this happens without major disruptions of learning? Is there any mechanism, or we just think of increasing regardless of whatever the action from students will be? The third one would relate to a challenge which I think is somewhat objective, but I'm not sure how we should actually resolve it. You arguing that you get to know about the allocation of these bursaries at the beginning of the financial year, which somewhere in April. And you wanted the situation where you get to know that in January, probably. And government financial year is April to March the next year. the kind of planning that should go into that, because we need to reconcile that. Otherwise, it will be something that perpetuates as if we can't find a solution to it. And I believe that there should be some solution. Whether you would need to know earlier on, as government starts its budget cycle, you interact with that process, and whether we can begin to know. But what I know as well is that at government level, we've got this 3-year period of projecting as to what should happen in terms of these allocations. And I think institutions of higher learning should somewhat begin to interpret that process, perhaps it could bridge the gap that we're referring to. The fourth is that most of the students that are in university, in your own understanding, they are not as ready to can be there. One mechanism to try and handle that was the bridging mechanism for bridging courses. Have they worked, or are they not working? Is there an intention to abandon what becomes the thinking at your level? Are you saying the solution is just to redirect them to FET colleges, or we should still sustain the bridging courses? And actually have a multi-pronged kind of approach to the whole thing, so that somebody does not just say, you are not ready, you ready, you not ready, and so on, just like that. I think we must find ways of also tapping into the potential that may be there, even if some of them might have come ready or not. The last one, you saying that some of the strengths of NSFAS is that they are able to distribute both private and public and private funds. When we're talking private funds, what are we referring to? Are they handling other funds other than those that, or are you referring to those that may be coming by way of donations, or what exactly? Just for us to be in the picture as to what is being taken care of there. Thanks.
Before you respond to questions, I would also love to put my question. Your presentation is very beautiful. I see ESSA here, Higher Education South Africa, but I don't see where you are located. Where do you find you, particularly in this document? I think our future dealings with you we should trace you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me quickly say that's an oversight. Our offices are in Pretoria at UNISA.
Sorry. Before you start, I have promised that I will call Mr. Fransman over to take over his role. I have promised that. Over to you, Mr. Kansel.
Thank you, Mimla Ketchum, for leading the discussion in the last half an hour. Which is sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Chair, one of the responsibilities of leadership is to delegate. So not to make this a monologue, I've decided democratically that I will delegate some of the questions to my colleagues, and I'll give them a chance to think about it while I answer some of the others. I would like Professor Chebeka to talk about the question of class distinction and the review of the threshold, please, as well as the mergers. In general, how have the mergers performed? If Errol, you can take those two questions. Professor Rachel Gumbi, two tough questions for her. The dropout rate, and what do we do and what can be done more? So that's the one. The second one is one that she has good experience on her, that is the increase of student fees, tuition fees. She does not mind to talk to that. And then Professor Malaza, he wanted, he had his hand up, so I'll give him a chance in any case, but I thought if he could speak to us about the question of blacklisting and the administrative capacity that we need in our universities to administer NSFAS. Chair, I'll quickly try to answer the other questions. I think on the first question by Honourable James, the capacity of APT colleges, no, they don't have that capacity now. I think it's a good first move to bring them into the national competency arena, away from the provinces. You know, if you're a province and you have 5,000 underperforming schools, then the 5 or 7 or 10 APT colleges in your province will not be the first priority. And therefore, I think it's a good start for the ministry to say, let us take care of that. I think that's the first point. Second point is we need to give the APT colleges some money to market themselves better. Students, learners don't know about APT colleges. Unfortunately, they see this as sort of a second-rate way to go, and that is not the case. I think that's very important. But certainly, and this is actually your question, the human capacity. And we'll have to have a training, intensive training for lecturers and staff for the FET colleges. We have the same problem at the universities. So they don't have it, we'll have to do something extra. It's not just recruiting the students, it's also making sure that there are people there to take the capacity. It is true that out of the 50 FET colleges, some of them have enough staff to grow to even double their numbers. So I think up to 1 million, we may be okay, but when we really look big, I think we really need more staff and better trained staff. The question of the graduation rate is a difficult one. Let me say, I'll try not to go to the question of dropout rates, although these things are linked. The graduation rate is a difficult one, Chair, just to determine what exactly it is. The very blunt instrument is to say, in a specific year, you take the number of students you have, say a university has 10,000 students. If 2,000 of those graduate or get diplomas in that year, then you've got a 20% graduation rate, which means that they took, on average, 5 years to complete the degree. Now, obviously, you have three-year degrees, you've got four-year degrees, you've got two-year diplomas, all of those, so it's a mixed bag. In some universities, we make the distinction that our undergraduate three-year graduation rate is X, a master graduation rate is that. So it's not an easy one to say it's this or it's that. Most universities have in class two resources that they use to assist students, especially first year students. The one is they use senior students. At quite a number of universities, there's a so-called buddy system or something to that, where a senior student would take a junior student under his or her wing and help them. And that's very valuable. And then secondly, and this goes to the question of the bridging or the foundation programs, we have specific programs where we have courses for students who are struggling. Now, most universities don't have bridging courses anymore. We call them foundation courses these days. It means, because the Department of Education said they will not subsidize, they will not fund bridging courses. What they will and do fund is to fund foundation programs at certain universities. And this means essentially that you start with your PhD, for instance. There's a science foundation program or a commerce foundation program. You start with your PhD in your first year, and you do the first year courses, but you do fewer, and you do it at a slightly lower level initially. And in essence, you do your BSc over 4 years instead of 3 years. That's the foundation program. And I have a sense that this has been working fairly well. I think the problem is that we don't yet have enough of those foundation programs. The minister, the previous minister, has asked the Council for Higher Education to investigate the possibility of making the normal three-year degree that we have now into a four-year degree with subsidy. Now, this would have a financial implication because all of a sudden, students will be there for 4 years instead of ideally 3 years. But we think it's worth considering that. Chair, then I'm going down the list that I've left for myself. The question of the statistics. I'm not an academic. I've got a PhD, but I was in business and in the NGO sector, and it's been a frustration ever since I started, the lack of management information in higher education. And if you ask me what's the reason for this, I think there are two reasons. The system works this way, that by June of the next year, so by June of 2009, universities have to submit the higher education management information to the department. Some miss the deadline, so we are to blame on the one hand. Secondly, even though it may have been done on time, the capacity in the department in the past have been so stretched that this was just not a priority, or at least it seemed that way from the outside. And so, for instance, last year, 2007 figures were published for the first time in March this year. So in March 2009, we got a very nice booklet saying, this is what the education system, it included schools, looked in 2007. Now think of it from our point of view. We must plan in 2009 for 2010 and 2011 with figures from 2007. It is a frustration. I think we as universities should take part of the blame that we don't keep those deadlines. But I also think we should look at the capacity, and I hope with a new minister there, with a separate ministry for higher education and training, that's one of the first things that they'll do. Next one from you, Honourable Chair, is the discrepancies amongst universities, and it also comes to the top slicing issue. I think NSFAS's rules are very clear, so there are no discrepancies in the merits, etc., etc. But what some universities do is that because they'd like to help more students with the limited funds they have, they actually give them half a bursary. Now, this is a very difficult situation, and I would imagine that I have to speak for myself here and not as here such a advice council of Northwest University. I believe you should rather have fewer students with a full bursary than help half of the students with half a bursary. Because what happens, and this is a dropout rate issue, what happens is that by the middle of the year, the student's funding is gone because he can't eat. I mean, many of the universities here today have what we call a meal a day fund, because students have money for classes, they've got money for books, even sometimes they've got money for accommodation, but they can't eat. And a student who can't eat can't study. So my difficult, and I understand it's difficult, especially if there are so many students wanting this, but do not give a bursary that doesn't cover reasonable expenses. When we come to transport and meals, obviously the administrative issue is a very big one, because it is open for fraud then, because you have to give cash. NSFAS doesn't, and universities don't want to give cash out, because then you've got a problem. So there must be a way, and especially if universities have residences where students can eat, that's easy to help with the money, where the universities have a fund. But if you have to give money out, it opens it up to all kinds of fraud. So I would say that the review of NSFAS would probably have to decide rather the one or the other, and say you cannot give an NSFAS bursary for less than X, because then it won't work, and you will lose a good student because of that. Rather have 5 good students go through than 15 students all drop out. Chair, second last one. Preparedness, I've spoken about the breaching course. Perhaps I should just say that as university managers, we are very concerned that this is not just a race thing. Learners from high school and their ability to read, comprehend, and write are declining. A number of universities in the country have a test that they do, a language ability test, in English and in Afrikaans at those universities, and the decline is marked the last 5 years. The children coming out of matric cannot read as well as 5 years ago, cannot comprehend as well as 5 years ago, and cannot write. Now, there are many reasons for this. It's probably SMS language, It's the fact that we watch videos and not read books. It's also the fact of the school system where we're not asked as learners to do comprehension tests. I think most of the people in this room are old enough, myself included, to remember that one of the important things in language in our days of school was a comprehension test. You had to read something and then you had to close the book and write down a summary of what was happening. They can't do it anymore. And we teach it to the first years now from afresh. So there are some deficiencies, that's the point I make. There are some deficiencies in the schooling system too that we should address. Final one that I'd like to address and then ask my colleagues to take over is the question of private funds, Honorable Makubela. And that is, it's mostly funds either given by universities. So universities would set aside some of their own core funding for bursaries, and they are in it supposed to administer those because they're good at that. Or it could be that there's a donor, like a company, private company, that would give bursaries to a certain engineering faculty or so, and that is given. So it's always for academic purposes. But it could either be the university's fund or it could be a private sector company's fund, but it will flow through the university. Chair, I think I've covered those that I wanted to, and I'll ask my colleagues to do their bit now. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm noting issues relating to either NSFAS out of this or the Department of Education, so I would want people to take note of those particular issues that you feel you want to respond to if you come from those two institutions. Because here in Parliament, we want to know what is the real issue. In fact, we visited NSFAS offices, and we then said, we've now heard their perspective. And that's why we thought we will bring in Higher Education South Africa as well as the student structure. And I'm not so sure if it was mentioned earlier about the students. Apology. Okay. Now, the students are currently in this week having a national discussion that will be factored into a meeting with a review panel on national students' financial aid scheme. And that's why they're not here. So after this week, at some stage in the future, they then will give us a perspective on their position. So they're coming with a uniform position. That's why they're not here. Otherwise, everyone else are here. Let me then give over to the other representatives.
Thank you, Chair. Our ESA Chair has asked me to talk to the issues of matching as well as class distinction and thresholds around national. But let's start with the measures themselves. On the average, we, on the fifth year of the measure of institutions, but outside institutions, we've been hearing this talk about measures not working. Perhaps once there's smoke somewhere in the fire, not so sure, but in the world where we live, in order for us to make statements, which in the end appear to be fact, I think they need to be really supported by evidence. And hence, I would like to inform the portfolio committee that in October, the universities in South Africa are having a conference on magic. And in fact, the focus of that would be measuring and evaluating progress in magic. It happens that my own institution will be hosting that. So I think this will be one level at which we're beginning to kind of get a sense of what has been happening. But I think we need to share with this forum that, for example, when our own measure was promulgated and working with the Department of Education. Our initial view was that the measure would be completed within the first 5 years. Yes, it's past that 5 years, and quite a number of things that were changed. But just simply in terms of infrastructural developments in these institutions, such that they can accommodate the changes that are associated with the measure. In fact, the funding came with effect from 2007 to 2009. And indeed, infrastructural development will delay a bit. And a typical example of the institution where I am probably will complete our infrastructural development in 2010, just addressing infrastructure that would make the, you know, the situation appropriate for the measures. So measures have been quite a new thing for all of us within the South African higher education. And indeed, we've been learning as we go along. I'm not going to give judgment in terms of where they are, but I just want to leave a sense here that perhaps we might have thought that managing institutions is a short-term process. But I want to assure you from the experience that we've had, our own sense is that probably it's going to take another 5 years for measures to settle and then begin for us to begin to harvest the benefits of that system. But again, this doesn't mean that we should simply generalize and say all measures will work. I think we need to look at each and every case, and based on the merits of each and every case, then we can take further decisions into the future. But I just want to caution against the thought of being magic. I think being magic would throw the system into instability, academic instability, for another 15 years. So, yes, indeed, we've been going through shifts within the system. And probably for many of the institutions, the worst is probably over and they're beginning to stabilize. And therefore, we need to give them an opportunity to do that so that our systems do stabilize. And we need stability in higher education. So I'm saying yes, indeed, from an academic point of view, we'll have an opportunity for evaluating measures, and we will be informed by that kind of evaluation in terms of how the system as a whole, as well as the individual institutions, will kind of learn from each other in order to plot the way forward. Let me then look at the second issue, which is not an easy one, but maybe it turns out easy, this class distinction in relation to Nestle. Again, I don't want to treat universities as kind of uniform. We are different. And therefore, you'll find great variations as you move from one institution to another. And hence, some of the questions that have come up here with can networks cover all the needs? I think that would be ideal, but whether we can do that it's another question. But also, the other issue is that in some of the universities, particularly rural universities, particularly those that have a disadvantaged history as well, what one finds is that the
majority of your students are really fast university entry students. They the first generation of the university, and they come from really poor backgrounds. And hence they need assistance. Now, the issue that all of us are facing, and therefore for me the race issue is not really a critical matter, because in the end, the bulk of the students that would need NSFAS will remain those from really seriously disadvantaged communities. But I'm not saying we should exclude other communities that are facing object poverty. So it should open up. But the bulk will be those from previously disadvantaged communities. So for me, it's not a major thing. But it might be important that as the portfolio committee also to consider that if the community cannot have a contribution towards even those students who are receiving NSFAS, then it becomes problematic, because NSFAS can't just cover everything. And indeed, the dilemma and that most institutions have is that you have this great number of students, but you've got a limited pocket of money to spend. And indeed, under those circumstances, the students will demand that a simply distributive method, which would ensure that you cover as many people as possible. And when you do that, then you can't give them a full bursary. And if you begin to say, let's give them a full bursary and exclude a number, then you've got a fight in your hand. Because some of the institutions don't even have this additional bursary that they can assist with. So you face with a tension within the university that you need to cover as many as possible, but as you do it, it should be such that it enables them to succeed. And hence, in trying to strike that nexus, terrible balance, what we end up with, and these are some of the unintended consequences. Our own surveys of student dropouts is that to a large extent a result of those students who do not have a full bursary and therefore can't continue the following year because they are owing the system a lot of money. And therefore they simply disappear from the system. So one would want to say that, yes indeed, I think as typical South Africans, we need to open up NSFAS to all disadvantaged students, including those who are probably not normally covered, but I don't think that will shift the equation much, because the bulk of the students will be coming from the previously disadvantaged community. But in the second instance, is that we might need to look at the actual allocation. Ideally, it tends to be a full budget. But in addition to that, I think there is no way that communities will not have a role still to support the students in order to ensure total success in the process. So communities still to make their contribution in one way or another in order to ensure success.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, I'm going to handle three areas because I'm going to amalgamate the two. First thing that I would like to highlight, that there is a range of the dropout rates. There are universities where it's at 28% and some are at 42%. This is linked to three issues. One, the types of students that have been selected, two, linked to support systems, and thirdly, also linked to the workload, linked to the numbers. What is therefore critical is that education support systems must be available for all these levels of students. What has happened is that for big classes, students are divided into smaller groups, both for tutorials and also the issue of mentorship by senior students and also the lecturers. The other element is the support we receive over the previous 3 years from the Department of Education, where we were able to provide foundation programs. Students who came from disadvantaged backgrounds were able to be accommodated by making them do 4 years instead of 3 years for a 3-year BSc. We also looked at the government priorities, science being number one, commerce being number two, and the humanities being number three. But we haven't lost control regarding the issue of education, which was also highlighted as a priority as the government policies. We have also noted in universities where the teaching strategies have improved, moving away from the old didactic teaching with a lot of interactive education, with support from audiovisual aids 206. A lot of universities got extra support from the Department of Education regarding improving the facilities, because in some institutions, although they were talking interactive education, where the old systems of the fixtures and lecture theatres, and therefore we also didn't have enough issues linked to audiovisuals, including facilities for promoting e-learning, that is the electronic version of supporting learning. The other thing, Honorable Chair, that I would like to note, we still have a problem of two big classes. We have a ratio of 1 to 300 in some of the institutions. We also have areas where it's 1 to 700, and the concern is it really feasible, even if you have the best audiovisuals, to reach all those students. The other element that is critical for areas like BSc in commerce is the correlation of theory and practical in the different areas. And these are the essence of the activities that are necessary. I will now proceed, Honorable Chair, to the issue of fees. To avoid any type of crisis, universities have embarked on a consultative process. It starts with the Dean of Students, with the student leadership, but in consultation with the student body. From there, it goes to the executive management regarding what is feasible according to the needs of the university. We also have students represented on the university councils, and when this issue is tabled for the following year, the student representative council is also part to that. There are a lot of issues. One, it's linked to tuition, increasing the tuition fees. There has been a debate that we should try and link it to the inflation rate on an annual basis. There is also the issue of the non-statutory fees where students benefit. And in most of these institutions, if it's linked to sport or computers or health or any type of support for the student activities, there's usually no debate in relation to that. But HESA has been participating actively in the last 2 years when the ministry was looking at how best to look at the rate that will be accepted by all partners, because this is one area that really destabilizes higher education. We're hoping with the new issues of the support, there will be some form of consensus. Over and above this, Honorable Chair, universities have the following financial support systems. One, they do have merit bursaries for students who are outstanding in performance. Two, they do have support, though it's minimal, for students who are needed, just to assist them with the initial registration. The third area is special bursaries, where some of the private sector would say, we will support students in commerce, students in science. So these are some of the special support systems that are critical. Lastly, Chair, regarding the support systems for students and the lecturers, the institutions do pay extra money. You know, if we use the old primary school system of platooning, if lecturers are supposed to duplicate some of the sessions because of too many numbers, there is an incentive that is provided. The idea being that it's far better, it's cost effective to deal with the personnel who are there rather than getting people from outside. So some of these are the elements, because the issue is that we cannot utilize national assets and we don't deal with the issue of the high dropout rate. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. First, on the issue of blacklisting, the first point is that the NSFAS Act authorizes NSFAS to blacklist defaulting borrowers. And this, in fact, follows on conditions of repayment that were made when the loan agreement was finalized. It's, the blacklisting takes place after a process within NSFAS, which sends statements to notices to debtors as to their status. And students are really blacklisted only when they cannot be traced. That is when there's no response to after that process. They are placed on a no-traced category. So it's in terms of legal requirements, and it follows after a process. It doesn't end there. There's also a process of delisting those students once NSFAS has managed to have borrowers to make arrangements for paying. So there is a process that takes place to delist students. It's not a lengthy process. To delist the student takes about 2 minutes once the contact has been made. Can I maybe address a set of issues on my capacity as a chairperson of a research committee of NSFAS that looks at strategic issues and advise the board of NSFAS, but also given my position at HISA, has implications for the sector. The research priorities we have set in the near future are to look at the question was raised, what happened to NSFAS graduates, to a tracer study, and to find what impact they are making in the economy. And they have a position on the return on investment. The second research area is around the means test that was discussed here, the issue of the threshold and so on. These are issues we are looking at. And also around that is the issue of that the means test is really driven by student information, customer information. We'd like it to be driven by administrative data so that it's linked to robust information systems in our country. The other issues we're interested in is the issue of stop slicing. That has got implications for equity, that if we have limited pool of funds, what are the implications? Do you find a few and give full cost and cover all the costs, or do you distribute on an equitable basis, so that everybody benefits? These are issues that you are looking at. The other one is the issue of underspending the return funds. There is that phenomenon that we'd like to understand. And also then lastly, the issue of capacity at our financial aid offices within our institutions. These are the kind of issues we're looking at.
Thanks a lot. Is there anyone else in from either NSFAS or the Education Department that just want to make a quick comment before we move over to the next presentation?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to respond and clarify some issues, but I should at the outset, I'm sure you would appreciate, I'm in an acting capacity as CEO, and I started last week. I am, however, familiar with the NSFAS because I was in the Department of Education. Commission and coordinated the establishment of the NSFA. I think the key issue that people have raised here, both in relation to the issue of the threshold, whether the 120,000 is adequate or not, and in relation to top flight and the fact that institutions distribute resources across all the needy students and therefore don't give anybody the full loan or bursary that they should be getting. And quite frankly, in many ways, in a very simple sense, the key issue that we face in this country in relation to the NSFA is that we require more resources. If we were to increase the threshold to, say, 150,000 rand per housing unit, we increase the pool of students that are eligible for the NSFA, and if there's not increased funding to match that, we end up with the same problem, that more students are eligible and the funding will be distributed by institutions, as the Vice Chancellor has suggested, in order to address what are very real social problems and individual problems that they face on campus. So in many ways, however we redefine the NSFA and whatever the administrative problems, if there are any, that need to be strengthened in the NSFA, and having been there for a week, I think there are many that need to be strengthened. The key issue for the NSFA is additional resources, whether it comes from the allocation by the Treasury to the Department of Higher Education, whether, as the Minister has been suggesting, we look at the National Skills Fund, whether we look at partnerships with the private sector, unless we bring in additional, significant amount of additional resources into the NSFA, the problem is not going to go away. Because the problem is not a technical one of the model of funding for the NSFA, it's about the amount of money that's available to the NSFA. So I think that's the first point. The second point I'd like to respond is I don't completely agree with Professor Tobeka, the issue of race as a proxy. Race, when the NSFA was established in 1997 in the legislation, the only proxy at the time in order to try to identify poor students was black. And so we very simply used black at the time in the department to try to define what a black student, what a poor student would be, knowing full well that it was not an adequate, that we didn't have the more nuanced socioeconomic understanding of where students were coming from. And so I think insofar as a few years ago the rules for the NSFA were changed, for instance, non-black South African students were previously also included in the pool, therefore institutions that had a large number of students from other parts of the continent were getting a larger allocation than they should be getting because their pool of black students was larger than it should have been in terms of the definition of black. So quite clearly, moving to a better understanding of what, in terms of income levels, where students are coming for and what merits access to NSFA in terms of socio-economic conditions, I think it's a technical exercise. Hopefully the review committee will either lay out a set of options or it should be possible to do so. So I think we need to accept that we need to move away as we go, as we move along with the NSFA, to move along from using race as a proxy for being poor. I'm not aware, and I tend to be corrected, but my colleague as the chief operations officer is here, I'm not aware of anything in the legislation that suggests that non-African or non-black students are not eligible for the NSFA. I think the way in which the definition of what was poor in relation to black as a proxy was used was then interpreted and implemented in particular ways to largely target black students. I haven't seen the figures, but certainly a few years ago when I was in the department, there were certainly some white students who were getting NSFA. I'm not sure what the figures are, but in principle, there is nothing in the legislation that precludes poor students who are not black from receiving NSFA funds. Then finally, I want to make some comments, because I'm not sure I fully agree with Professor Iloff and the colleagues from ISA in terms of the allocation process. I think we have to be clear. The allocation, the institutional allocations, which are driven by a formula, institutions are informed towards the end of the year, at the end of the academic year, as they are for the subsidy formula that government gives them. So by December, in fact, by mid-December, all institutions should know both what they're getting from government in terms of the subsidy, but also what the allocation for the NSFA is. So I don't think it's correct to say that information, is that what was there, what I have understood Professor Iloff to be saying, I may have misunderstood him. The problem he raised was the time lag between the state financial year, which is the 1st of April, which impacts on all institutions, not just in relation to the cost, but also in relation to the subsidy formula, because the first funds to institutions are transferred on the 1st of April. However, institutions know, in the past, the Portfolio Committee on Education previously has raised the issue of students who are unable to register because institutions don't have these upfront payments from governments. As far as I understand it, and I tend to be correct if you can stand it, that in the last 2 years, institutions that require advanced funding have been provided advanced funding by the NSFOS. I also understand, if the briefings and discussions I had with my colleagues last week, that there are institutions who don't ask for those funds. And finally, in relation to allocations, and I don't want to go into detail because I'm trying to find my way around this at the moment, but I, in discussions with Linda, who is at the core of the operational allocation process, as we speak, there are institutions, and I'm not talking of institutions who don't have capacity, let me administer this then, who have still not submitted what their final allocation requirement for this year are going to be. So the issue of unspent funding is partly explained by the fact that institutions are not able to provide the NSFOS with the information in a timely manner. This is not to suggest, and I think Hisa has rightly raised, that the whole range of problems administratively with the loan agreement forms, etc., and the processes in place, I understand, to try to save electronic loan agreements and the technical problems with some of that. But there are very real backlogs or constraints in the way in which institutions submit information. So as we speak, in August 2009, there are institutions who are still not indicated in terms of the allocation they have been made, how much of it they're going to have spent. Now, they've registered students. Even if they've registered students for where they have a semester system and the 2-semester registration, by now, that information should be in. That information is not in for institutions. So I think that there are some very real problems in the way in which data and information from institutions flows into NSFOS. This is not to suggest, as I said finally, that there are no administrative and other problems at the NSFOS. I think there's a lot that the NSFOS needs to address, but I think we need to identify where these problems are, so we assign appropriately try to identify where the problems are. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot. The lady next to the acting CEO.
Kate Menon from the Department of Education. Just to point out that at the beginning of this year, as well as last year, we began a process of monitoring the uptake of universities of the facility from NSFOS for the advance payments. And one of the findings that we had this year was that several institutions had not utilized this, despite NSFOS making this available. So we've been trying to work quite closely and strengthening our monitoring of this, each year. So we've been working both with NSFOS as well as with institutions and requesting information. The same has applied this year with the fee increases, where last year when funds were allocated to institutions on the basis of inflation, we asked institutions to indicate in advance what the fee increases would be so that we could, in a sense, be more prepared to deal with the registration issues which surface at the beginning of every year. Just to come back to the point of the NSFOS review, the NSFOS review committee has been working since the 1st of July and has met several times already. Some of the key challenges as set out in the terms of reference are, for example, how does one define poverty? What are the thresholds that can be set? What are the thresholds in relation to the resources that are currently available or resources that we need to look for further resources from Treasury deal with this? We're also looking at what is the affordability, in terms of the sector. how many students can be supported, what is the ideal package, and what is the relationship between the ideal package that NISPAS provides to the student in, as well as in relation to success of the student in terms of academic success. But bearing in mind that there are other factors which may be which may result in dropouts. Some of the challenging issues that we've been looking at within the review committee are the current model of NISPAS is institutional allocation, and whether money follows the institution or should money follow the student. So how does one allocate funds to the students who are really desperately in need? So these are just some of the issues which, of course, require quite sophisticated modeling, so that once one begins projecting need for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years, looking at it far more broadly than just higher education, but taking into account the FET sector, taking into account the possibility of inclusion of not-for-profit institutions, what does this really mean, and what does this really mean in terms of funds? We also are looking at the model of the current model is a decentralized model. So NISPAS funds are allocated to the institution and the institution allocates to the student. And we are looking at the efficiency of this, as well as whether there are other support mechanisms that should be in place for students who require funds. So these are just some of the issues that hopefully we will be able to provide the committee with a far more substantial report later in the year.
Thank you. The last two.
There was an issue raised around blacklisting, and I just wanted to clarify the process. Again, Linda can correct me if I've got something wrong here. Students only pay after they graduate and they get into employment and they earn a certain level of income. So if you are unemployed or if you're not earning whatever the threshold income is, it used to be 125,000, I'm not sure what it is currently, then people don't pay. I also understand, I may be wrong here, is that where students who are earning but have difficulties can make arrangements with the NS Trust to order to get a longer repayment period, etc. So really, it's not a punitive measure. It's a measure for those people who can afford to pay and are not willing to pay. And I think the point about this that we need to recognize internationally is South Africa is one of the few schemes in the world in which there's large amounts of recouped funds coming back into the students. I forget, it's 400 or 500 million then currently. Most schemes internationally fail because people get the loans and don't pay back. Because of the peculiar nature in which we created it, the link to the tax system, etc., and it's something we should not, quite frankly, it's something we should encourage people to pay, if they can pay, without it becoming punitive.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I just want to respond to the question of cash payment to students. While the fundamental rule remains that no cash should be given to a student, however, the board approved the cash payment policy in 2008 to address instances where the university cannot provide that service internally, and therefore there were conditions around that process. For example, the universities may make certain disbursements of the loan of bursary amounts to meet the cost of prescribed books or other material, including assistive devices for students with disabilities. Fees for a student boarding, lodging, and off-campus accommodation. I think we're all aware of the fact that universities are unable to accommodate all the students at their residences, and therefore some students therefore opt to seek alternative accommodation elsewhere. Again, it includes transporting a student who lives off campus to and from campus during the academic year, and also paying an allowance to a student where the applicable bursary or scholarship agreement provides for this. And I think it's important that, you know, these allowances should only be made in cash to students where no other means of payment, such as wizard card or smart cards or inter-account transfers, electronic transfers, or vouchers can be provided to a student.
Just two brief comments. I want to wish the acting CEO of NSFAS not good luck. That's got nothing to do with it, but staff, as we say in Afrikaans. Could I say I have mixed up, to use good South African, the two issues slightly, the financial allocations, which was done earlier, and the payout. And I take his point. I think it has been better. I think our point is that it should be part of the process. It should now be made a rule rather than the exception. And finally, Chairman, I just say on behalf of the university sector that we really appreciate this opportunity. You know, last year was the first time since 1994 that higher education has had the opportunity to address the parliamentary portfolio, and I think that was an oversight on both our part and Parliament's part. And we hope in your first year as parliamentary portfolio committee, you've set a good example. We are willing and eager to accept such an invitation every year. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can I just summarize this part without getting into the conclusions and way forward, because we will be doing that at the end, by saying that it's quite clear to us that there is a lack of synergy at times with all the role players, and that there's not a strong, coherent, institutional approach when it comes to the cooperative nature of working. And I will be able to expand on that at the end. That's one. And a simple reasoning in that would be, if we look at the supply and demand issues and what we get out of the institutions and what our economic growth trajectory and the challenges they require, then clearly there's a mismatch. You didn't answer this. I was completely off track, but I've asked a particular question. And the question was, do we know where the dropouts over the last couple of years are as we're speaking? The province. I would assume that answer is not able to be forthcoming. I heard you played with management information system. You used that flag to give an answer, but I was looking for an answer in a very particular way. Yes or no. So that is a real issue. Now, acting CEO, it is a problem that we are seeing actings over the last year or two at NSFAS in any case. So that in itself is an issue that I think the committee would be able to take through our report. We need stability, a very serious stability at an institution with the type of monetary support and the strategic objectives, which is very noble stuff. But back to what you've raised in the context of additional funding, I think I buy that argument, but I am a subscriber to a view that we always want to throw money to some of our problems. Whilst the existing stuff, we will not able always to appreciate. Now, you raise it significantly in the context of uptake of numbers, and therefore, so I understand that. But if we are having a 42%, 45%, or 35% on average drop-off rate, how much money are we actually throwing away? And therefore, compounding that with the reality that you as educationists know better than where I'm sitting, the fact that our quality of education is in dire straits, there must be a radical intervention to in fact deal with the quality of education. So we can add significant more money into that system, but will that mean the dropout rate will increase because these basic numeracy and literacy issues that we are grappling with currently? So it's that contradiction that I hope that from where you are sitting as part of the review analysis, you will be able to grapple with. The The issue on the graduates. Doctor, it is, apart from the dropouts, it's the actual graduates. And are they in service of our people, or they are in service of Canada? And it's something that you're only able to analyze if you quantify it properly, if you actually look into that detail. So that's the other element that I hope that you take back. Clearly, we will write the report and we will take it to Parliament with very clear directives in that regard. But there is an issue on that score. I think out of all the presentations from the three institutions, what I've also picked up, if there is support to students at all levels, they definitely perform better. So whether it's financial, whether it's capacity, whether it's mentoring, all those support. And hence, in the existing constraints, can we therefore do more in terms of the quality of our throughput rate at institutions? It's something that we have to reflect on. With that, then I want to go to the next part of this. We've invited two, I think, KZN, a project in KZN, which we got through the institutions, higher education institutions, and they unfortunately were not able to make it, and a project which I somehow have a little bit of information on at the level of, that deals with the support when it comes to students in the existing envelope of funding, in a sense. And it's the question of coordination and a comprehensive approach in our interventions. We hope that the KZN project in some time in the future will be able to get that. So I'll hand over then to the representative dealing with this particular. The reason for this is that we would want to see, as a parliament, not only identifying at a minimum level the issues, concerns, but we also want to start suggesting in terms of directives.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and members, for this opportunity. I want to talk about a particular program called Masaki Sizwe, which you will all know is Let's Build the Nation. This is a project. I'll go into the history of that, and then I'll talk about some of the good aspects of that, which I think will address some of the issues that have been raised here this morning already. The background to this, of course, and you well know that through ESA, et cetera, was the shortage of engineering and built environment professionals. And we did a study through the Department of Transport and Public Works, I should have said, so that this program is actually located within the Provincial Department of Transport and Public Works. It's essentially a bursary program, but it goes further than that, as you will soon see. And we looked at, from the year 2006 to 2010, what was the supply as a percentage of the demand? And if you look at civil engineering, we faced a critical situation where in 2006, 10% of the needs of the economy in the Western Cape was met by the supply. So that's where this thing comes from. So we had to do something, and then, as it goes up, as you'll see, by 2010, hasn't improved much better. So what could we do, particularly to get more engineering students, more people studying engineering, but also to address throughput rate, which is one of the issues which has arisen here. Okay, as I said, it was launched by the department in February 2006, and it's for students who are studying in these fields in the higher education institutions in the Western Cape, and there are particular reasons why we limit it to the Western Cape, and you will see that in a minute. The core values is that we wanted to develop a cadre of nation builders. This was not simply a bursary program, so we're not handing out bursaries to engineering students, but we wanted nation builders who are committed to the economic development of the country, to social justice, to environmental sustainability. and I'll talk a little bit how we introduce those core values into the program. Okay, so the vision was what grand. The vision is centered to make available to the province, the country, the continent, and Africa cohorts of professionals in the engineering and built environment fields. And I must say the Honourable Chair at this point in time was pushing us for this kind of vision. He was MEC for Transport and Public Works when this program was started. So we were looking beyond the Western Cape. We were, in fact, even looking beyond Africa. Beyond South Africa. I don't think we've really got beyond South Africa yet. So the professionals will be characterized by learning. So we wanted, to let them get good academic results. That wasn't a criteria for admission to the program. But it's part of our support that we encourage this and more than encourage this. But also a commitment to lifelong learning so that students understand that it's not just simply a question of getting a degree at the end of the day and that's going to get them a job, but it's a question of being committed to an ongoing process of learning because the field changes all the time. Citizenship, I've mentioned that, non-racialism, social justice, environmental awareness, and service through learners participating in development of under-resourced communities while they are still learners. I must say that that's the weakest part of our program, and I'll talk about a little bit of challenges around that at the moment. Okay, obviously, that's to award bursaries. Now, the important thing here is that we prioritize financially disadvantaged learners from the beginning. We did not speak previous disadvantage in these categories for precisely the kinds of reasons that have come up here that you might have poor whites and rich blacks. We were not just looking for black numbers. We wanted to address the poor. And that meant that we actually had to go out to the schools in the poor areas to recruit. So obviously when you do that, when you're looking for financial disadvantage, your numbers kind of meet the employment or the equity target. So it is around about 85% broadly black. Half of those in the Western Cape are broadly African. But also especially women and learners from rural communities. We have two reasons for those priorities. One is, and I always ask the students at the beginning, why do we prioritize women? And they say, oh, because you've got such small numbers. Well, that's partly true. In the engineering and built environment sector in the Western Cape, if you look at all the professionals, yeah, there's probably 5% of them are women. But that's not, in my view, one of the main motivations, my understanding, and from just talking to the students, is that women have a better sense of the communities from which they come. So they're not interested in simply building a road. They're interested in building a road which is going to suit the community. And therefore, it means looking at what are the children's needs, etc. So you don't just build a road through a community which is going to have a whole lot of accidents in the future. So that's... it's just that they come with that sense. I might be prejudiced here. And then learners from rural communities. Also, we don't get the perspective. We don't have the opportunities. We don't go out to rural communities. And for the same reason, people in rural communities will understand the needs of the rural areas and the development better for those areas. So though we prioritize those, that doesn't mean that we exclude others in all those categories. To develop an attitude of service, I'll talk about that later, and then to develop a professional identity in the learners by offering them life skills and leadership training by establishing mentoring partnerships. Look, well, I'll talk about the life skills and the mentoring later. This is all part of a package. And then, very important to contribute to a collective identity amongst the learners. This, I believe, is one of the key. And you'll see our success rate is very good compared to the national average. It's early to tell, still too early, but the trends that we have at the moment are showing a really good success rate. And I believe it's for two reasons. One reason that has come up here already is that we give complete financial packages. It's not an 80% loan, it's 100% academic. It's 100% residence, and then it's 100% food, It's 100% of all the minimum book allowances, etc., that they need. So all of that is covered. We also do give them a cash allowance for transport if they're living far away from the university. And now, preferably, we don't want them to live. So we'll do all in our means to actually find accommodation very near the university. So administrative staff actually help them to find accommodation. Because we don't want a student who lives in Khayelitsha studying engineering to have to go back home at 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. to Khayelitsha when, if you know an engineering program, it's a full day's program. In other words, they'd never get a chance to go to the laboratories to the computer laboratories or to the libraries after work. They need to be close to where they're studying so that they can make use of the university's facilities that are after the normal teaching hours. And let me go back here. The other aspect that was important is what we might call it's this collective identity aspect. It was touched on earlier where students were saying, look, this is our first generation. This is the first generation of many of the students from rural areas. Now, if it's first generation, they are completely alienated by coming into our universities, most of our universities. They have no understanding. So to bring them together, all of these first-generation students to mutually support one another, we saw as an and that's what's known at UCT, at least as the effective domain. So the main reasons for dropping out are the finance and the effective domain. So if we can provide them with support, and if we can provide them with support, we find that, I believe, that our throughput rates are a lot better than the average. We have an advisory board that sits outside the department, and some of these figures, I mean, the chairperson is Dr. Rampele, and some of you who know her know that she's very energetic around education issues and is a very active. This advisory board doesn't just meet twice a year, they actively engage. So we have all the deans of the faculties of engineering campus. So if we have problems with the faculties, we can address them directly. We have industry bodies like SACSEC, professional bodies like EXA and SACI, municipalities and state-owned enterprises as members of this advisory board. To give you some understanding, I've just broken down into the percentage women. I could give you all the details of, we do keep the so-called race statistics, but I'm not going to give them here. 2006 we started. Our target was 250 bursaries. We got 227, 34% women. 2007, we got to 213 bursaries, 45% of our bursary holders were women. 2008, we pushed it up to managed to get to 296 bursaries, a little bit of a drop in the women, 41%. And this year, 299 students on bursary, 42% of them are women. So our targeting is working in a sense, in terms of our goals. Learner enrichment. We talk about life skills. Now, from our point of view, students who have got into an engineering faculty at one of our institutions, be it CPUT, Stellenbosch, or Cape Town, they've already got, and they're coming from the background they come from, they have incredible life skills. They're already survivors to be able to get to that position, to get a sufficient matriculation pass, especially to get into UCT or else or Stellenbosch. So the life skills there is more around helping them to understand themselves and how they relate to others. It's helping them, in other words, to adjust to this community they now into the university community. And it's a particular program that we take all first years through in terms of these life skills. So what you call it a profile testing, where it's a very simple but profound way in which they can get to understand themselves a bit better. And what are their strengths and weaknesses, and how can they play on their strengths and develop their weaknesses. Leadership, the exiting students, just before they exit in their final year, we take them on wilderness camps. That serves two purposes. It consolidates what they've learned, but it also helps them to to strengthen their group work. They have to go into an industry where they're going to have to work with others, but also it helps them to understand them better the environmental issues because they're going into wilderness camps. So that's a week-long camp that they're all taken on to. Mentors, we have extensive mentor support now. Buddies, this has already been mentioned, where senior students adopt first-year students. We call personal mentors, and that only happens at UCT and US at the second and third year. The reason we don't do CPUT is because in the second year, CPUT students are out in the field. They're doing the experiential learning. And they will, in any case, be interacting with people in the field. What we want them to do here is interact with a senior person, an older person who's not an academic, who helps them to understand who they can relate to on a number of personal issues. And obviously these people are not skilled at dealing with, but they would know where to refer students to. And then finally, the professional, the final year students, we start linking them with engineers in that field. And that's engineers drawn from our partnership, and I'll explain that in a minute. And volunteer work. We do them, these students, while they're working, they give maths tutorials in 9 schools in Philippi, Khayelitsha, Manenberg at the moment. That's our biggest weakness, in that we'd love to do more, but we don't have the resources and finances to do that. These kids take maths tutorials on a Saturday morning, and the principals are very excited about the results because they see the maths marks shooting up. Now, I don't think these kids that are the university students are good teachers, but they do know they have two things that go for them. One is they know their maths, which a lot of teachers don't know. And two is they're an excellent role model, because you're seeing the kids in these schools are seeing someone just a little bit older than themselves that's studying engineering at UCT. They never even thought of studying engineering at UCT. So it's a tremendous inspiration, even in that final year, the final 8 months of that year, to now start working hard at maths, and we see the results of the maths, or the principals tell us, they see the results of the maths going up remarkably. So I would like to see this kind of thing being done by all university students as part of their graduation, that they do volunteer work in certain areas, in particular in the schools. Achievements, I'll talk about our throughput rates, I'll give you some figures there. I'll talk about our bursary collaboration venture. I'll talk about the employment uptake. The question was raised by the Honourable Chair, what happens to our students? Those are the main things, but let me go down. Throughput rates. UCT, it's difficult to compare because we don't have the strict cohorts that the universities have. We can just look at our present failure rate and anticipate what might be. But we reckon in the UCT engineering course that 79% of our students, and remember the majority of these students are black, and most of them, 95%, come from poor educational backgrounds, whether they're black or white, will qualify within 79 in the minimum time period. When you look at national figures of 30%, and at UCT, UCT engineering and built environment, this is based on UCT's figures given to us, 38% will qualify in the minimum time period. After 1 year, difficult to say, but I think we'll be up to 90% after 1 year, the minimum plus 1 year. UCT's, they can do it more accurately, and they're talking about 56% after minimum plus 1 year, and 61% after minimum plus 2 years. I think it's excellent. I hope our figures are right, but it's on track. We've now traced them for 3 years, and we seem to be, it's more or less
the faculties are also part of the analysis.
We're very much part of it. Our advisory board has been very helpful in this regard. U.S. Masaki at the University of Stellenbosch is 65%. U.S. Engineering at Stellenbosch is 58%. They have much more intensive support for the students than at UCT, actually. But when you look at their black students, that looks very bad. And they're very embarrassed about that because U.S. engineering, the black students, only 25% will pass in a minimum time period. And you'll see that number stays 25%. It's because most of them drop out. Those that are going to continue will stay there. Most of them drop out in that first year. The first year is a big challenge. And I think it's the university environment that's a problem. I also think it might be something to do with the funding structure, but we're not entirely sure about that. And of course, nationally, if you go down here to CPUT, we have a minimum 70% throughput rate in the minimum time period. I don't know what the national figures are in engineering, but we are getting 47% in a plus 1 year. So, but we know in any case that the national diploma is very, very poor in its throughput rate. They face an additional problem in the national diplomas because, and one of the key constraints there is that they need an part of the diploma is a 1 year long or a 6 month long experiential learning where they have to go into industry. If they don't get that, they don't graduate. And so it's something that we pay a lot of attention to, so we can safely say that all our students have had that experience. We make sure that they get that experience. We're dealing with smaller numbers, of course, when it's on the institution, the responsibility of the institution to this. It's almost an impossible task at the moment to make sure that all their students get that experiential learning. But some of them, they'll be sitting there for years before they even get that experiential learning opportunity. So no wonder they have, and that would account for a very low throughput rate at the CPUT. Bursary collaboration venture, what we have there is a number of partner companies. At this point in time, 9 of the big construction and state-owned enterprise companies. And the benefits of that, well, what the basis of that is that they will pay 50% of the bursary cost. We pay 50% of the bursary cost. Those that come into this collaboration venture. The benefits are there's a database. We have a complete database which we can all share and which is accessible to all the partner companies. And they will know exactly who's where at what point in time in their study program. Experiential learning is a big benefit for the students, so all our students will then get the experiential learning that's required. Graduate employment, you'll see that 98% of our students were all employed in South Africa and not in Canada. And as I said, cost sharing. Membership, there's a state-owned enterprises, construction, well, it's down from 12 because there's been a merger of companies and then there's some cities. City is pretty much on board, Stellenbosch and Eden, we're still trying to get them on board. This is a picture of our graduate employment. In 2006, we had 26 graduates, 18 went to the department, and 8 went to our partners. End of 2007, we had 56 graduates, 42 to the department, 11 went to partners. Some were released from their bursary for various reasons. I won't go into those details, but there were 5 problem areas there of the, and that year we had 290-something students. And then 2008, 59 graduated, 19 go to the department. We'll increasingly be using less and less in the department because the department is not wanting to employ so many people. And 22 went to the partners and 16 went to municipalities. So of the total of 141 graduates since the start of the program, 77 have gone to the department. I do need to say here, so that you understand this better, that we're not taking students only at first year. We're taking students throughout. So we might have picked up students at the second year and at the third year level. And we work very closely with the university's financial aid offices because they will then be able to spot which students they think are doing well or should be supported. They might not be doing brilliantly. They might have probably failed a few courses. but they had not been excluded by the universities. In other words, they're doing well enough to continue, but they're struggling financially. And so then they will identify those students and pass their names on to us. Okay, we've had some recognitions. Premier Service Excellence Award, we've got an Impumelelo Gold Award for what we've been in, that's particularly focused because of the partnership that we've gone into. Challenges, professional development of graduates. I want you to just talk about some of the challenges. Sustainable numbers of school leavers with university entrance, it's been mentioned here, and service learning. And financial, long-term financial sustainability. The problem that we're facing now that we have to deal with is we're getting the graduates in engineering, but what happens to them afterwards in terms of getting their professional qualification? That's our next step. Because it's all very well to have a graduate in engineering, but we still need another 4 years after graduation of work, of particular kinds of work, to get your, to be recognized as a professional engineer. And in government, we don't provide all the kinds of work that they need. So that's where our partners are now coming to the fore, and we're able, they've offered at no cost to themselves to let our students, our graduates, work on projects that they have developed, that roads construction, particular kinds of roads construction, etc., so that they get that professional qualification. We want them to get that professional qualification in as minimum time as possible. If possible, 4 years. It's more likely going to take 5 years, but the minimum time is normally 4 years. So we're developing this program, private sector companies and the South African Institute of Civil Engineers helping to provide resources for the program. School leavers, mathematics competency. This is a preliminary study, and maybe it shouldn't really, it's still very preliminary, but one of our universities has done a study of those who've graduated, who've come into the university, they've got the marks, the points marks in maths to get into the engineering and science faculties, but only 30% of those who are getting those marks, and it's that number still debatable, won't be much more than 40, 45%. Of those that are meeting the getting those maths marks are actually able to do the basic maths and science first year maths. So that's a serious, serious problem that we face. And I think there's been mention here of a 4-year degree. I mean, obviously it's going to take a long time to get the schooling system turned around, but if we talk about so-called 4-year degree and an additional year, that might be the place where we can address at least the math and the language competency. Comprehension tests, for example. But then there must be some other things that I think could be added on to that. But those are going to be the key factors for the student success. So I've said that. Basic academic literacy, understand how to go through academic texts. Service learning. I've mentioned already that that's weak because we don't have sufficient personnel. There's a number of schools that would welcome this, but we don't have our staff. You have to understand that the staff that I have are mostly at levels 4 and 5. They're all on short-term contracts. They're about a 1-year contract at a time. I have one other staff member who's at a level 7. And three at level 7. Only one other person is on a full-time staff. This was because it was set up as a ministerial project by our chairperson here. There wasn't a structure in the department to actually resource this, so we had to then go through another route to actually resource this this program. So, and these. And they're very willing, but to ask them also to go out at weekends is on top of the work that they're doing. And they provide a lot of support to the students. Students know that they can phone in at any time from a certain campus and they'll get someone to talk to them, to talk about problems. And we meet with the students regularly. We do meet with them on Saturdays. We meet with them every quarter on their campuses to understand the problems that they might be going through. So, service learning, if that could be taken over by universities, if universities got into as a requirement for graduation that their students actually do some time service, and it can be as simple as taking maths and English tutorials on a Saturday, I think it will do a lot to assist with the throughput rates at school as well as at university. Just our financial model to give you a sense. We run, what we talk about is we aim to keep our bursary numbers level at 300. So if, say now we get a graduate, 70 graduating at the end of this year, then we'll get award 70 new bursaries. So we're keeping that at that level. The budget just for bursaries is 13.5 million for those 300. But remember, this is covering everything. The province gives 9 million towards that at this point in time, going up steadily. That's the MTF period commitment. NSF, we've got funding out of NSF, 3.1 million. We've had 3 years. We've already done at the 08 or 09. We've got 3.1 now.
So that is the National Skills Fund, which the minister talks about the possibility of, and this was somehow piloted in this place already.
Yeah. Look, my view is, knowing how much, maybe I shouldn't say this, but knowing how much money is wasted in the National Skills Fund, I think all this talk about where you're going to get your resources from, there's a huge opportunity there. And I'm very pleased that this has now come under the higher education sector, because it will deal also then with your FET college resource needs and so on. So I think, and what we get there is this window of opportunity that we have to apply for. It's a limited amount of the National Skills Fund, and we got this, and we've applied again. We don't know if we're going to get it for these outer years. Industry, through our partnerships, we're raising 2 million. This is what we're raising. So we come up with a positive balance there. We're going to, because we don't know what's going to happen there, we're not sure what's going to happen here. But it works out at a cost per student of about 50,000 per annum for full cover. And that includes our staff costs. So it's about, if you add another 1.5 million onto this 13.5, that gives us 15 million in all, approximately, for the staffing cost to support the students in the way that we do support them. So to close with a few student comments, you can read them. And there's our chair. What about first? This is a graduation ceremony, so you can get a sense of the students that we've got there. Not graduation, sorry, awards, bursary award ceremony.
Thank you, Dr. Luck. I think I'll open for questions or input. But I think the model really tried to show that whilst we talk about all these things to be done, these most probably models in South Africa that have started to pilot some of that. And then the question is, can you massify in a responsible way? I think those are the issues that I'm noting, Dr. Jane.
So congratulations. I mean, it looks like an excellent program. Could you just say a few things about how you talent scout? Because obviously talented students happen to be there. Since you're not simply looking at first years. So there's second and third years that you can pick up. And some students obviously turn up at the door. But one of the key things, I think, has to do with how one sniffs out talent, wherever that engineering talent might be. Can you just tell me how you do that? And then I had one of the dilemmas, which the chairman might be able to talk to us about as well, is, I mean, to me, I'm utterly perplexed. It's incomprehensible that we don't have proper sanitation systems in Khayelitsha. Because there's no science problems to be solved. It's the application of engineering that requires this devotion of, you know, resources, skill, and pipes. and so on. I'm simplifying it a little bit. But why did that? So, it clearly has got some links with graduating engineers, but it's a delivery project. But I'm so puzzled by why that's so.
Anyone else? Member? George?
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a comment to the effect of this. It's a very good scheme. It sounds very, very good. The fact that it targets the poor, and I hope it's a free bursary. It's not like NSFAS, you don't have to pay when you work. And on completion, most of you must name your graduates get employed. And you actually get the universities themselves. In fact, analyzing how you perform. So it's not that we're getting information from you which might be cooked. And it strikes me that, however, that in 2008, your women percentage-wise went down by 4%. And what is the cause of it? Who were awarded the bursaries? That's the question. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. to start with, there's a page that is missing. I checked my neighbor. Page 2. I don't know whether it was a mistake. After this Western case supply of September, there is one page that I don't have. Okay. I'm looking at this and I understand that this is Western case, right? Okay. Because I'm looking at this on page 3. It's like I'm not sure I know exactly where this is getting the resources come from. But if it goes out with bullet number 2, the core values of the program are to develop a cadre of a nation builder. Of course, this nation builder also has inverted commas. You can draw a lot of money because you talk of a nation. Can it be corrected and say maybe a province builder? Because clearly we appreciate it for Western Cape. And yeah, this wonderful. But then you cannot go out there and have values of a nation and get money and deal with a particular problem. Thank you.
Member Lakatra. Shwana, just put on off the mic. Member.
Oh. Thank you, Chairperson. I am and how Masaki is doing in the province. You are saying that you get your people from the rural, particularly women. I just want to know the criteria that you are using to recruit these people. Secondly, we're doing very well. What is your staff complement? Thirdly, is that I don't want to miss you any longer. If you could just provide your physical address and contact details. Thanks.
Thank you. Can we get the responses and then look at the way forward?
First question on talent scouting. You know, we believe in trying to find potential, but that's what's very difficult at the start. Excepting that right at the beginning, the universities provide it. You know, they could say that this person is doing well, has the potential, doesn't have the money. Can you support? Our partnerships with industry is playing a more and more important role in this regard because two of the big companies have a year-long internship before they go to university. So they bring in these, they identify kids, the same kind of targeting that we do. They bring them into a program, a year-long program of internship, and then they'll be able, by that end of that year, be able to say, look, these people are suitable for engineering or not. And in fact, the success rate of students that come through that section is very, very high. Then, of course, our math tutorials has provided, because it's just the enthusiasm. You get the people that are coming to those tutorials are getting more and more enthusiastic about engineering. And I think we've discussed this quite a lot. Are there any particular tests? And all of our companies, some of them use tests, but they say these tests aren't that reliable, the aptitude tests. And what is much more important is the enthusiasm of the student to do this, the willingness to succeed. Of course, we do have, and some of those dropped out, you know, I said there were some others. Some of the students decide very soon that they're not for engineering, and then they'll move out. We do, and this relates, so we don't do much more than that. And the way we advertise, and I think that might address some of the other questions, is we advertise through newspapers, now coming up in September, beginning of September, we'll advertise in the province. And I want to talk about that in a minute. That's financial constraints. We advertise in the province. We don't, it's not only for people in the province. A lot of our students are actually working in other provinces, some as far as Limpopo, quite a number in the Eastern Cape, and so on. So we're not restricting where they work. We're not, because these companies, don't forget, have also got, they run their engineering throughout the country, actually. So we advertise, and we then make a special effort to go to the rural areas of the Western Cape. So we've been to perhaps spend a day at a school explaining this to various parts, Oudtshoorn, Vredendal, all over the Western Cape. We don't simply have the resources to go beyond that. We don't. If we did have more money, we'd happily go further if we had some more. So that's, by and large, talking about the talent scouting. When we select to say something about the section, we'll get a number of bursaries and a number of applicants, maybe at this point in time around about 400 for about 80 positions. We do a very crude cut-off. We have those that have come through the companies, and they obviously meet our criteria. But we just give points. So for financial disadvantage, you'll get 2 points if your family income is less than 50,000. If your family income is less than 100,000, you'll get 1 point. If your family income is below that, you'll get nothing for the financial disadvantage category. If you're a woman, you'll get 2 points. If you're from a rural area, you'll get 2 points. So it's a very crude cut-off, and then so we'll get that cut-off, and then we'll start debating, we'll look more closely at the possibilities. We've never interviewed students consistently because we don't have that capacity. The only way students are interviewed is those that come through these companies. The question as to why women have dropped off, it's simply we just don't have enough applicants. We don't have enough applicants that will be it. Remember, we can provide the bursary, but the universities have to provide the place for study. And if they don't, so what we'll do is we'll offer the bursaries. We aim to offer those bursaries by Christmas so that we can inform the students. Sometimes it's a little bit later that we offer that. But it's a provisional offer. That offer is dependent on them being admitted to the university for engineering. So we can't offer a bursary and then they want to go and study science or commerce or something. Then we won't give them the bursary. Okay. So it's for engineering. It was set up for engineering. It was set up to deal with the engineering shortages in South Africa. Maybe while I'm on that, this issue that you raised about Khayelitsha, I don't know why we have a situation like that in Khayelitsha, but maybe it's an area where students could be, in terms of their community work. It would be an ideal thing for them to actually do. It's just very difficult for us to manage that. That's initially what we wanted to do. We wanted to look at all sorts of community projects, but it just became really difficult to manage. But if we can, but that would be ideal because it's a simple, as you say, a simple engineering task. Payback issue. We offer full bursaries, but students sign a contract. And they sign a contract with us to work for the department or one of our partner companies if they come through the partner company. That doesn't mean the contract is a bit one-sided. So if they've got bursaries over a period of 3 years, then they'll work, they contract to work for 3 years. And so far, it's too soon to tell, but quite a number of them are just wanting to stay on. And so that's the one way that they actually do pay back. That is the only way they pay back. So women went down, nation builders, but we talk about nation building because we want them to understand that they're not, the idea is in contrast to building roads, they're not here simply to build roads or schools or whatever. They're here to build the nation, South Africa at large, and bring in certain values. As an engineer, you'll become a citizen, and you need to bring in certain values. You need to understand that when you build a road in a particular community, that you're not just looking at the technical aspects, but you're looking at a number of other aspects. That's what we call it. And so we will target students in the Western Cape, but we don't exclude other students, and we don't prevent them from working elsewhere. If we come to an arrangement with people in Pretoria, wherever they'll come, we'll have an arrangement. So they can even go and work in the Eastern Cape, and some of them have done so. But if we had some more, I think it's a program that's replicable throughout the country. So it could then become more than a provincial builder. It could become a genuine nation builder because it would be replicated throughout the country. Staff complement. What we do is we have myself as director of the program, but it's in a matrix management fashion, so that I sit outside the normal line function. That has its own challenges. But what we do have is for each of the campuses, and now we're talking about four engineering campuses, and the campus would be CPUT, two CPUT campuses, Bellville and Cape Town, Stellenbosch and UCT. So we'll have what we call a campus coordinator and an assistant to the campus coordinator. Those are level 5 and level 4 posts. So they will then look after the students. The students know who to go to if they're having problems. That's their first point of call. We then have someone who manages the experiential learning, who's responsible to make sure that all our students get experiential learning, and also to manage employment. So even if we don't employ them or if one of our partner companies don't, we undertake to try and find employment elsewhere. So that's what, and then we just have a special events that's to cover all these other programs. We have to send them on leadership camps. We have to arrange for the skills, the life skills, and a number of other events that we have. So we have one person dedicated to that. We have a person who manages all of that under myself, and then myself gives direction.
Thank you, Dr. Luckett. let me say that the issue on 98%, what you've raised of employment in South Africa, that people actually remain, and you showed that slide. The reason that I'm very interested in where graduates go to, and particularly to Higher Education South Africa, also is because of in my own little way, we've made an analysis a few years ago, where we've seen that in some institutions, especially at scarce skills, that 3/4 of those students have actually left South Africa 2 years after they received their degrees. So there is that real challenge. I said it to my committee, I think a while ago, that in the year 2000, 200 new graduates of engineers came into South Africa, paid by NSFAS and a range of other support. And in that same year, 200 experienced ones left South Africa. Now clearly that speaks then to the challenges of supply. supply and demand and all that. And then it's the question of how do we cohere. Member Mushwana, the issue about provincial fiscus, if you are actually getting, it's not a national, it wasn't national money, it's provincial fiscus, and therefore you need to account provincially. However, that program has pushed the envelope. I think at least 20% plus of all the students are actually from outside of the Western Cape. So it's students recruited, and that brings another contradiction with provincial treasury. Let's say, why do you therefore need to fund a student coming from KZN, a student coming from Free State, a student coming from Mpumalanga? That's the reality. However, I think the project has erred on the side of pushing that envelope, even including at least 20% plus of all the students from outside of the Western Cape. But that in itself is a risk if you look at public financial management approaches in terms of what you need to fund for. Then just on the issue of, I think why the model was able to be effective, and I think there's different weaknesses in that as well. It relates to, can you pull the different departments, can you pull the different institutions in the province, can you link at the supply? Members remember our discussion in Strand a week ago around how do you position training and education in the context of the needs of a particular geographical or regional space, and how do you then bring the different institutions together. Differently put, Higher Education South Africa, I think, would be able to tell you that there's not good solid cooperation from where they are sitting to what the provincial government necessarily are looking for. Alternatively, the provincial governments, wherever they are not necessarily speaking to the Higher Education South Africa because it's a national competency. And how do we understand our regional support where we can give to these various institutions. Can I then advise members that this debate is not closed, because we are moving to the point where we are making an intervention to the department's, you call it review committee. We will make an input to that review committee in a very direct way, but before we will also call on the review committee at some stage, and I think that we've dealt with the acting director general of higher education and training. We will also get a report from the review committee on where they are going with this. The reality is we need much more support for students, not only financial, but also other type of support. And we are testing different models of how it can best work in the South African space. The Dr. Elof has also given me now information around the whole notion about the tracking and the reasons why it's not happening, capacity and financial and all other reasons. And we will take it up with our Department of Higher Education and Training around starting to work on a model. How do we start institutionalize that issue, both at dropout as well as graduates deployed. Also, if one tracks the support that government has given students, what actually happens with graduates when they enter the public sector space? Because remember, the recall is the public sector are saying we do not have enough engineers, architects, quantitative surveyors, etc., doctors, etc. That's the problem statement. So now we are putting graduate training in place, and then they come into the system. But what we found is that the system is not conducive for learning. Meaning a quantitative surveyor or an architect at the Department of Housing or Department of Public Works or so on are actually not getting real training when that person comes into become an architect in government, because we are outsourcing as the state a lot of the work, not necessarily wrong, but we are outsourcing the contracts. So if I'm a young graduate coming from NISFA support and the call is I must go and work into the government space at the municipality, will I get, and the person X, Anele, goes on the same year, but he goes into the private sector, meaning he's not supporting the public sector space. He goes into the private sector. In 3 years from that, he's going to be much more experienced than myself because of the lack of the type of support on actually work experience in the institutions in the public sector space. That is a different debate. But it's a debate that has serious implications on the way we, for example, graduate, and we need to find synergy. And I'm just throwing that to that's a discussion with the bold environment, in a sense, of South Africa. With that, members, I would want to suggest that we then draw up a report out of this meeting, and that we'd be able to then meet the students themselves at the appropriate time and make our final submission to Parliament in terms of all the meetings that we've now dealt with on this issue and our analysis around the constraints. Member Lachetso?
Thanks, Chairperson. There is a question that is not answered. That is your, where are you based, your offices and your contact details? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lakers. What we'll do is we'll make sure that both Yesa as well as the presentations that were made, that is all the, just the information distributed to the members, so that that's clear with that. I think we want to thank members. If we...
Honourable Chair, there are two things. I just want to go back to some of the comments. One, it was the issue of the capacity in these higher education institutions. We want to stress that from 2006, NSFAS has blessed, and they visit these institutions as part of capacity building. Secondly, the officers there also allow bilaterals with the officers. So that is improving. The third area from 2006, there are awards that are given to institutions that are doing well in relation to support systems in NSFAS. Lastly, Honourable Chair, I just want to respond. In health sciences, we have done some case studies regarding the people who go to the rural areas in Canada, in Australia, United Kingdom. The key professionals that have been there is medical doctors, is dentists, is pharmacists. Nurses are also going now to Saudi Arabia. We have had the changes. After the introduction of community service for health sciences in 1999, there has been some improvement because they can't get fully fledged registration unless they've done the internship plus the community service. But the evidence is linked to the fact that they say, one, it is the attractive salaries and benefits outside, two, they have to pay back their loan bursaries whilst they are involved in education, either 4 years or 7 years if it's medical education. The third area is that at least that now the policy from the government is saying we should look at recruiting them back to our country, you know, in relation to better benefits. We're hoping that it's going to move us forward. The question is, are we really giving these people values that make them altruistic? So it's one of the questions that must be taken forward regarding service provision and employment. Thank you.
No, I think thank you for that input because it endorses the strategy of beyond just the technical focus, but also the societal responsibilities. And how do we link all of that? In fact, Doctor, that there is more than 1,000 engineers currently in the United Kingdom only of South Africa. And we are facing, if you in fact look at Eastern Cape, there is serious infrastructural challenges, but more so, budgets are not being spent just based on pure technical support that we've got. So the issues around scarce skills is critical. And we do know that this but speaks to a category of the support that we're supposed to give because there's FETs and there's the youth that will never be able to go to higher education, but that's also a different discussion than this. And I think I'm picking up that we are saying that we need to explore the link between NSF funding and the national skill, the NSFAS program, in terms of the additional capacity that, that NSFAS requires. So that's also something that we'll be taking forward. I would want to ask then that the members just stay for 5 minutes, and then we will be excusing our guests. So with that, thanks a lot, Regina.